It is Friday, September the 18th. Good to have you with us here on VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the situation for migrants and refugees is changing in Europe.
At the Munich Central Station, people were applauding, cheering the trains as they were coming in. You don't see that anymore.
Also ahead, a coup in Burkina Faso, and in U.S. politics, rivals pressuring Trump in the second Republican debate. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The European Parliament is back to plan to distribute some 120,000 refugees among European Union member countries in an effort to relieve the overcrowding in the EU border nations that are the first stops for migrants seeking asylum. The next move is for the EU interior ministers to approve that plan, provided they can change the position of each European nation, especially the eastern ones, that are against it. Meantime, while welcoming several hundred thousand of the refugees, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cabinet called for expansion of the country's naval operations in the Mediterranean to block human traffickers from ferrying more migrants. VOA's Luis Ramirez is in Munich, Germany, out among the refugees. International Edition's Susan Yaki asked him how the EU nations are responding to the refugee crisis.
Well, it all started with Germany, which, of course, the destination of choice for many of the migrants coming in. Germany imposed border controls on Sunday, and that set off a whole domino effect across Europe, Western Europe, and Eastern Europe as well. One of the flashpoints being, of course, Hungary and Serbia, the border there, Hungary sealing its border to migrants coming in from Serbia. We saw some clashes, tear gas there, very tense situation still there. Austria also imposing border controls. It's not as easy to come through anymore. And so what that's meant is a number of bottlenecks. The big conflict right now is between Germany and other members of the European Union, as they continue to say they will not accept, or a number of them say they will not accept the quota that Germany wants, 160,000 migrants per country.
This is going to have a long-term impact on the region. Any idea what that might be?
That is a very big question that is on the minds of many people. The general attitude in Germany continues to be one of welcome. It is not, I should say, I've been here several days now, and I've noticed at the beginning the trains were arriving at the Munich Central Station. People were applauding, cheering the trains as they were coming in. You don't see that anymore. What you do continue to see are volunteers pouring out, bringing food, bringing money, giving their time to help the refugees as they come in, medical staff on hand at the station to provide them with whatever medical care they might need as they come in. But the city officials and members of the public, I've been talking to people on the streets, I've been doing interviews, and while people say they do want to help and that Germany feels an obligation to help these people, there are questions coming up on the minds of many people about how Germany will absorb them. Will there be enough jobs for everyone? You know, Germany is Western Europe's richest country, and it has the highest GDP, a pretty low unemployment rate, less than 5%, but still there are unemployed people in this country, and that is causing concern among people who wonder, will Germany actually be able to integrate them? There is the question of demographics, with the birth rate low, and there are critics of immigration in this country, mainly in the far right, who are raising questions about what the face of Germany will look like. Germany is still in the process of transforming into a multicultural society. That process began in the 1950s when it started to bring in guest workers, mainly from Turkey. But nonetheless, there are some concerns about what it will mean for Germany demographically.
And as VOA's Luis Ramirez in Munich, Germany, more than 430,000 migrants, including refugees from Syria and Iraq, have crossed into Europe this year. Migration watchers are saying that nearly 3,000 of those have died in the process. Head of Burkina Faso's new ruling council says the president and the prime minister are safe in military custody and will soon be released. Brigadier General Guibert Diendier spoke to VOA's French to Africa service late on Thursday, a day after soldiers overthrew the country's transitional government and arrested its leaders. Emily Yob has more from Abidjan.
Confusion reigns in Burkina's capital city, Ouagadougou. Soldiers from the presidential guard stormed the ministerial council Wednesday and took the country's president, vice president, and other ministers hostage before taking them away to their camp. As news spread, several hundreds of people gathered in the streets with the intention of freeing the prisoners. But soon, shots were fired to disperse the crowd. These protesters say it's not right. They are not allowed to shoot, he says. The protesters are not armed. He says everybody should be released. Early Thursday, a soldier, Colonel Mamadou Bamba, announced on state television that this is indeed a coup.
Le président de la transition est démis de ses fonctions. Le gouvernement de transition est dissous.
Bamba says the interim president is dismissed from his function. He says the transitional government and the National Transition Council are dissolved and that the consultation will take place to form a new government in charge of organizing inclusive elections. Burkina Faso was due to go to the poll for the first round of the presidential elections on October 11th. It has been a year since a popular uprising ousted former president Compaoré, who has tried to change the constitution to seek another term after 27 years in power. Earlier this year, transitional authorities enacted a new electoral code barring anyone who supported Compaoré's effort to change the constitution from running for office. The former ruling party condemned the measure, saying elections wouldn't be free and fair. The coup leaders pledged to organize inclusive elections in their statement Thursday. International Crisis Group analyst Cynthia Ohayon says the new electoral code upset the opposition. She says when one doesn't have the possibility to hope get back into power through the ballot, one is tempted to get it back through a different way. She says it's quite obvious that the former ruling party doesn't have the capacity to massively mobilize the population behind them, but it was also obvious that they had enough support within the army to raise the specter of a possible army intervention. On Monday, a government commission recommended disbanding the Presidential Guard, an elite military unit created by Compaoré and known by its acronym, the RSP. The fate of the 1,300-man unit has stirred tensions since Compaoré's overthrow. In February, civil society took the street to demand it be disbanded, accusing the unit of political assassination during Compaoré's rule. In July, the RSP called for the Prime Minister and former RSP second-in-command, Isaac Zida, to resign after he called for the unit to be disbanded. Ohayon says change is inevitable. She says the RSP doesn't have justification for his existence anymore, at least as a unit to protect the president. So changes have to happen, and the RSP knows that. She says that what is certain is that they will need an elected and legitimate authority to process these changes. Ohayon says the international community has a key role to play in resolving this crisis, as it can leverage the international aid that Burkina Faso depends on. Emilia Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
Humanitarian groups say 240,000 people in Somaliland face severe food insecurity, that due to prolonged drought. The rains, which normally fall between April and June, were poor last year and again this year. Hassan Noor is country director for Somaliland and Somalia for Save the Children. He speaks now from Nairobi with VOA's Joe DeCapua about the drought conditions in Somaliland.
At the moment, the situation in Somaliland is becoming worse because they have failed rains, and because of that, they have not been able to produce agriculture, or they have not been able to feed the livestock well, and then there is significant shortage of water. This is an area which is quite remote in Somaliland, and therefore it remained undetected for quite a while, and therefore humanitarian assistance is needed. And these are the people who are towards the Djibouti border and the area which is between Djibouti border and the Red Sea. the coastal belt area, that is where the main problem is.
Now, I understand that a number of communities are taking, quote, desperate steps to deal with the situation. Can you explain what that means?
So the desperate steps are that they are selling their livestock. It's important to note that around 75% of the community here is agro-pastoralist, and they rely heavily on livestock for their livelihoods. Now the situation is such that to sustain their lives, they have to sell the livestock. Because there has been no rains, the condition of livestock and the health of livestock has really deteriorated, which is resulting in selling animals less than half the actual price. For future, they don't have any particular mean to cope with any shock. And the other thing that they're doing is they're migrating, so they will be leaving their homes and coming towards the towns or moving into the other side of the Ethiopian border to gain refugee status and get assistance from the agencies on that side.
Now, I understand that children have been particularly hard hit by the effects of the drought. Could you tell us about that?
When we did assessment, we realized that the average meal for children is one per day. And that is now resulting in an increasing level of malnutrition. I saw some of the very, very severe cases of acute malnutrition. I'm running nutrition programs for the last 10, 12 years, but I have never seen such cases of malnutrition. And that was alarming.
So what can be done?
The humanitarian community needs to step up. Donors need to put more money into the response. And then there needs to be a significantly scaled up response, particularly in areas of water supply, wash, nutrition, and food. So these are three immediate things that need to be done for the population. And then in the longer run, there would need to be efforts taken to improve animal health and then provision of fodder or other livestock feed so that the animals are not dying.
Hassan Noor, country director for Somaliland and Somalia for Save the Children, was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. This is VOA.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Turning now to U.S. politics, where Republican frontrunner and billionaire Donald Trump took center stage and took plenty of fire as 11 Republican presidential contenders for 2016 held their second debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone has the story.
With President Reagan's Air Force One as a backdrop for the Republicans, Donald Trump was on the defensive, as in this exchange with Kentucky Senator Rand Paul.
His visceral response to attack people on their appearance, short, tall, fat, ugly. My goodness, that happened in junior high. Are we not way above that? Would we not all be worried to have someone like that in charge of the nuclear arsenal?
Mr. Trump, I never attacked him on his look, and believe me, there's plenty of subject matter right there that I can tell you.
But
there were several clashes between Trump and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, including this one over the Iran nuclear deal and the war in Iraq.
The lack of judgment and the lack of understanding about how the world works is really dangerous in this kind of time that we're saying. So is that the judgment that you bring to the table, that Hillary Clinton is a great negotiator, that she could bring about a better
deal with Iran? Your brother's administration gave us Barack Obama because it was such a disaster those last 3 months that Abraham Lincoln couldn't have been elected.
You know what? As it relates to my brother, there's one thing I know for sure. He kept us safe. I don't know if you remember.
The debate also featured the only woman Republican contender, former business executive Carly Fiorina, who was asked about a recent Donald Trump insult about her appearance.
I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
I think she's got a beautiful face, and I think she's a beautiful woman.
Some of the other contenders thought there were too many testy exchanges.
If I were sitting at home and watching this back and forth, I'd be inclined to turn it off. I mean, people at home want to know across this country, they want to know what we're going to do to fix this place.
Most of those on stage were highly critical of the Obama administration's nuclear deal with Iran.
If I am elected president on the very first day in office, I will rip to shreds this catastrophic Iranian nuclear deal.
But Jeb Bush and Rand Paul said they would not tear up the agreement, and Paul warned against sending U.S. troops either into Syria or back into Iraq to confront the Islamic State.
There will always be a Bush or Clinton for you if you want to go back to war in Iraq. But the thing is, the first war was a mistake, and I'm not sending our sons and our daughters back to Iraq.
Others on stage included Florida Senator Marco Rubio, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and neurosurgeon Ben Carson, another political outsider who has soared in the polls of late. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And now it's time to catch up with International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here, about what's being said on Twitter about that debate. Hi, G. What are the contenders saying on Twitter about their own performances in the debate?
Hi, Steve. Let's start with what Donald Trump tweeted because he strongly believes he's a winner of Wednesday night's debate. So it's no surprise he's tweeting so much about the debate and also retweeting his family's tweets about his performance. Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump are sending out supportive tweets about their father. But going back to Trump's own tweets, here's an example. Every poll done on debate last night, from Drudge to Newsmax or Time magazine, had me winning in a landslide. Hashtag Make America Great Again. That's been retweeted almost 2,300 times and marked as a favorite nearly 5,000 times. As a reply to that tweet, a Twitter user wrote, Fiorina was much better. That reply was marked as a favorite almost 60 times.
And of course, G, that user is referring to Carly Fiorina. Did she tweet anything about what she did in the debate?
Surprisingly, no. She shared a photo and video clips from the debate, but didn't say whether she's pleased with her performance or not.
Interesting. And what about Ben Carson, who's been second in most of the polls behind Trump?
Steve, a lot of people say Carson did fairly well last night. He sent out this tweet after the event. A leader that understands what you say is important, not how loud you scream it. We the people won the hashtag CNN debate tonight. Hashtag BC to DC 16. Now that hashtag stands for Ben Carson to DC 2016. More than 2,200 people shared that tweet, and he also tweeted a link to a Washington Times article titled The Secret to Ben Carson's Quiet Rise, Likeability.
And, of course, they're the quote-unquote underdogs among the GOP contenders. What are they saying?
Steve, among the smaller players, Lindsey Graham did pretty well. He's a senator from South Carolina, and he shared two articles about his performance. A Washington Post article said, Graham shined Wednesday night, and a Times article wrote, he dominated the Republican undercard debate. That's all for me today.
And many thanks to you, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can follow G on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Simon Daly makes a living crafting violins inside of his shop in Canberra, Australia. And it's not unusual for him to spend 200 hours making, by hand, just one instrument.
People can choose the wood, they can choose the color of the varnish as well, how much wear there is in the varnish.
What Daly cannot do is make them quickly, unlike the fast-growing 3D printing industry. Today's 3D printers can work with much more than plastic, including metals and food. Some companies are even experimenting with porcelain. James Antibob owns Made For Me in Canberra.
Let's say some 15-year-old comes up with the next great musical instrument, puts it online, gets 1,000 people to sign up to get one made. 3D printing can do that.
Antibob doesn't have any orders for a 3D instrument just yet, but by 2020, the 3D printing industry will be a $20 billion business. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis's upcoming visit to the United States has excited the tourism industry in the cities of New York and Philadelphia, where events are expected to draw more than 1 million visitors. And in one New York Italian neighborhood, it's the face of the Pope himself that's generating all the profits and satisfying the customers. Ramon Taylor has our report.
Welcome to Belmont, the Little Italy of the Bronx, New York, and home to Artuso Pastry, a bakery and cafe that is gearing up for Pope Francis' visit with a special edition dessert. Traditionally known as the black and white cookie, a signature New York shortbread pastry with chocolate and vanilla icing, the family-owned business came up with the idea for a papal variation during Pope Benedict's visit in 2008. Atop the cookie, the vanilla icing becomes a tasty paste for edible paper, printed with edible color ink featuring Pope Francis' face. The bakery's manager says some Catholics are afraid to eat it.
Some of them want to frame it. Some of them want to freeze it. Some people are afraid to eat it. They think it's a sin to eat it. And some people are the complete opposite, and they think it's a blessing to eat it and miracles might come from it.
At $2.95 a piece, sales have rocketed. Baker Sergio Hernandez says making them is a source of pride.
As a Catholic, it gives me joy to place the image of the Pope on a cookie. I'm proud to be one of the people that's doing this.
But not everyone is sold. Doris Murray, a loyal client at the bakery and fan of Pope Francis, thinks it's all a gimmick.
This whole cookie situation, or the pictures, or give your money to an organization that he advocates for and believes in.
For the bakery's manager, it's about creating a satisfying experience. Her goal is for Pope Francis to try his cookie for himself. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
And now a bit of something from the music world. Well, the nominees for the CMA Awards have been announced, and VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong chats now with International Edition's Sarah Williams about them.
Well, last week, the Country Music Association has announced their annual awards, and I know, Nikki, you are the country music authority here, particularly compared to me. Let's go over some of these categories and get some of your predictions. Okay, first up, Entertainer of the Year.
Okay, so Entertainer of the Year, you have Garth Brooks, Luke Bryan, Kenny Chesney, Eric Church, Miranda Lambert. Now, these are all great artists, but I think Garth Brooks is going to win. Now, he took 10 years off. Over 10 years off to take care of his family. And then he returned with a worldwide tour. He's been selling out venues. He's been adding new dates. And he wound up being the highest paid country artist on the Forbes list of top paying celebrities. So I think that speaks to his staying power. So I think he may actually walk away with that award.
Well, we'll have to see. Okay. And now what about Album of the Year?
Okay, so Album of the Year, you have Jason Aldean, Old Boots, New Dirt, Pageant Material, Kacey Musgraves, Painkiller by Little Big Town, The Big Revival by Kenny Chesney, and Traveler by Chris Stapleton. Now, a lot of people, Chris Stapleton has really gotten a lot of respect. He doesn't have the commercial weight as some of these others, but many people believe that his album is truly the best album of the year. However, Little Big Town had a humongous crossover hit with Girl Crush, and so if the commercial factor really winds up tipping it, it'll go to Little Big Town.
Okay, Female Vocalist of the Year.
Okay, this is hard. Now, first of all, Reba McEntire should have been nominated in this category. She was snubbed out of all the awards, which concerns me. But she was snubbed. Now, this is a hard one for me. The other ladies in the category are Miranda Lambert, Kacey Musgraves, Carrie Underwood, Leanne Womack, and Kelsey Ballerini. I think it's going to be between Miranda Lambert and Carrie Underwood. Carrie Underwood is like the it girl right now. And so I think she may actually have it, even though I would love it if Leanne Womack got it. But that's just me. We'll see.
Okay. And what about the male vocalist?
Male vocalist. I think this is even harder. You have Dierks Bentley, Luke Bryan, Eric Church, Blake Shelton, Chris Stapleton. These are all great guys. But I think Luke Bryan has been on fire this year. He's had multiple songs on the charts at once. He had an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, which I think is pretty hot and speaks to his popularity and his legacy. And I think that commercial success will translate into Male Vocalist of the Year.
Okay, and last but not least, New Artist of the Year.
Okay, now Chris Stapleton has potential here because his talent really warrants recognition beyond just a nomination. But I think Sam Hunt has taken the country by storm. His songs have hit number one. They have stayed there on the charts. I remember Take Your Time and his current number one hit, House Party. They were in the top five for a while on the Hot Country Singles chart. So I think his sound is very indicative of contemporary country music and the direction that it's going.
That's Nikki Strong. She's the host of Country Hits USA. You can tweet Nikki at @VOA_music and also look her up on Facebook at VOA Music. We'll have a house party. We don't need nobody. Turn your TV off. Break that boombox out. We'll wake up all the neighbors.
That's the guy, huh? Sam Hunt singing on the radio somewhere. Is there still radio, folks? Oh, I don't know. Well, that's a debate for another time. Hey, before we go, we've got one more story for you here. A new song by Tejada star Selena has been released 2 decades after she was killed by a fan club president. Selena's father, Abraham Quintanilla, says he found a recording, the song, Oh No, Never Fall in Love Again. Found it a few weeks ago. Selena sang a verse of it a cappella during a radio interview, which was later posted on YouTube. And the tune was arranged by Selena and was before she was fatally shot. That was back in March of 95. A big event. Selena has a new song. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America's International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead, so you want to stay tuned for that. Our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Russia is expanding its military support for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whom it has supported throughout a brutal conflict that has taken the lives of over 250,000 people. Secretary of State John Kerry called Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on September 15th, expressing the United States' concern that a Russian military buildup in Syria could further escalate the conflict, lead to a greater loss of innocent life, increase refugee flows, and risk confrontation with the anti-ISIL coalition operating in Syria. Russia claims its military support for Assad is aimed at defeating terrorists like ISIL. President Barack Obama said September 11th that Russia and the United States' common view of the ISIL threat creates a potentially converging interest. But, said President Obama, the bad news is that Russia continues to believe that Assad is somebody that is worthy of continuing support.
It has been my view and the view of the United States government that as long as Assad is there, he has alienated so much of the Syrian population that it will not be possible to arrive at a peaceful ceasefire and political settlement. And you'll continue to have this vacuum that's filled by extremists.
President Obama said, "You can't continue to double down on a strategy that's doomed to failure. If, however, the Russians are willing to work with us and the 60-nation coalition we've put together, then there's the possibility of a political settlement in which Assad would be transitioned out and a new coalition of moderate, secular, and inclusive forces could come together and restore order in the country. That, said President Obama, is our goal."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
For